Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Boston University's Phil Haberkern rejoins the program to talk about Tyrion's preparations for the Siege of King's Landing. After my conversation with Phil, I include a short excerpt of my conversation with medieval warfare expert Kelly DeVries. His book is Medieval Military Technology. If you have a question for someone like Phil or someone like Kelly, you can send those to book@baldmove.com. All right, without further ado, here is Dr. Phil Haberkern. So today we're covering a Tyrion chapter.
Can I ask, I'm sorry, I have to ask one question, though, because I just listened to the House of the Undying chapter.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Which was, I thought, hilarious.
Little chaotic, that one.
A little chaotic.
Kind of different energy that I usually go for with this podcast.
Well, it freaks me out a little bit because I was just like, I don't have this kind of investment in fan theories, and I don't think we need any dragon roaring sound effects when we talk. So I feel like I'm going to be a disappointment.
Oh, all right, I won't use any then.
But it was, I will admit, I was laughing out loud. I was walking my dog while I was listening to it, and was sort of, you know, laughing out loud as I walked down the street, and at least once someone was crossing on the other side of the road and suddenly looked up at me with alarm as I was cackling to the podcast. So that was fun.
All right. Well, I think it was a little by design. I did think, who are the fans that I think would be most invested in this? Because I don't feel as invested in fan theory, but I know that that chapter is a really important chapter to a lot of fans.
Yes.
So I thought, what I need to do is I need to bring on folks who are really passionate about this so that their energy can kind of carry the episode.
Well, mission accomplished.
Yeah. I maybe I got a little bit more than what I was expecting.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, so Phil, I usually kind of relish Tyrion chapters. Is that how you feel about Tyrion?
Oh, I mean, these are among my favorite, if not my favorite.
And, you know, it's usually like you'll get some kind of bit of strategic wit and wisdom. Mm-hmm. You know, usually he'll have some kind of quip that will be entertaining. It may or may not have sex. This chapter, he's a bit like a, I don't know, like a university administrator.
A little bit.
He's sort of going from office to office, prepping for some big event. And so there's a lot going on, you know. I mean, every conversation that he has gives you a different window into siege preparation. But it's a lot of walking and talking. This could easily be like a episode of The West Wing. This could be an Aaron Sorkin Tyrion chapter.
That's actually a great description of, you know, sort of in the hallways, out of the public eye, doing all of the necessary work. The sausage is being made.
He seems to enjoy it.
Yes.
He doesn't seem like nervous or, you know, it's not wringing his hands. It's sort of like keeping himself busy. There's 19 different moving parts to this event. He's the guy with the big picture, and he seems to he's a fish in water, it seems.
Absolutely. And I that's the interesting thing about this is it's a chance for him to display expertise and leadership, which is traditionally denied to him, you know, because of his physical limitations. And so you see him, he's making himself vulnerable in some ways for the good of the city by sending away his clansmen. He's advocating policies that he knows they will make him more unpopular in terms of clearing out the sort of structures on the outside of the walls. He's balancing the sort of inner workings of the Kingsguard versus the pyromancers versus the City Watch. But I'm with you. I mean, this is where he wants to swim for sure.
I think that from a novice's perspective, once you build the wall around the city, and you know, you've got your defenses set, if there's a siege, you put the men on the wall, you shut the gates, and you wait, right? But this chapter makes it seem like no, there's tons of things that you have to do to prepare for a siege. So do you know of any literature where people talk about siege preparation, like, you know, in this kind of detail?
Oh, that's really interesting. You know, I wasn't looking so much at the literary when I was thinking through this chapter. I did look at some other sort of historical, like famous historic sieges from the Middle Ages and then just into the early modern period. Because I have like, there's a rant on siege warfare in literature and movies that I'm not going to indulge in at this point in time.
Okay.
But it's just, you know, sieges could last an incredible amount of time with careful preparation. You know, 6 or 8 months is certainly not beyond, you know, it's not a stretch of the imagination.
Right.
And so all of this kinds of preparation of laying in foodstuffs, trying to weed out potential traitors, shoring up the defenses, all of that is, we do have some clear records of it. For instance, like the siege of Antioch during the First Crusade. Where first the crusading army besieges the city for 8 months, they eventually get in and then in turn are surrounded by an opposing army. You know, we have a pretty good sense. Yeah, it's a disaster. They're only saved by a miracle of the Holy Lance. So that's like a good case where we know a lot of the dynamics around starvation and treachery and just want of resources. Or like the Siege of Orléans in the Hundred Years' War is another one we know a lot about. That's another 8-month siege that's ultimately broken by Joan of Arc. So like we have these cases that we know a lot of what goes into it. And it seems to me, besides, you know, wildfire as a sort of trump card that I know you've done a lot of work on, this feels in line with what we know about siege warfare in the later Middle Ages.
I think I should probably read my synopsis of this chapter so we can
get
into the details here. After sending the last of his wild clansmen into the Kingswood, Tyrion observes 3 trebuchets built for Stannis. He hears the complaints of a dozen captains who have yielded their ships to the war effort. Then he spends most of his day attending the installment ceremony for 2 new Kingsguard members. He talks with the High Septon about Stannis' new religion and with the Pyromancer about their unexpected proliferation of wildfire. He talks over preparations with Bywater Braun and learns from Varys the names of a number of traitors. Philip Habercurn, was there a particular bit of this chapter that caught your attention more than others?
That's a really good question.
Or do you want to talk big picture stuff?
No, I'm happy to talk little picture stuff because I think there are certain things in here. Like, it's fascinating to me the sort of implicit contrast between Bywater as a figure who's sort of in the background but absolutely central to the action versus the more obvious defenders of the city, the Kingsguard. Hmm. And it ties back into this idea of, you know, Tyrion and expertise and finding the people who can do jobs and incentivizing them in certain ways versus the sort of political gamesmanship of appointments. And so I don't know. I love how throughout this chapter, whether it's the new High Septon, whether it's Bywater, whether it's the Klansmen, it's always this contrast between the people who get things done and the people who look great in snowy white cloaks with big black beards, you know? So that to me is one of those like sneaky things throughout this chapter.
Yeah. You really get the sense here that the Kingsguard, the politics of choosing a member of the Kingsguard is so much more important than their actual, you know, ability to defend the king.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone in Bywater's spot, it's like, no, you need someone who men will follow into battle. Because if that guy can't do his job, this whole city falls. And, you know, not to say that the politics are less important than, you know, than the battle commanders. But both are necessary. And Tyrion has to be able to negotiate both in order to kind of keep this whole thing afloat.
Absolutely. And I mean, even with Bywater, though, you know, he's the one who sent to secure Tommen and hide him away. Like that's beyond his brief as City Watch commander.
Right.
Because, yeah. You know, Tyrion has recognized like this is someone who will do what is needed. And so there's that moment where it's almost a test, right? Yeah. Tyrion says, you know, and where did you put him? And Bywater has, again, this close to witty repartee as we get in this chapter. You know, you told me not to tell anyone. And that's kind of those subtle back and forth that, I don't know, it's on the one level, it seems like a relationship of trust or mutual respect to some extent.
Right.
But also, again, like this difference between, you know, Sir Osmond Kettleblack, who's informing on Cersei to Tyrion versus this one, I don't know, maybe not honorable, but at least dependable commander.
Yeah, one of these guys is a hammer and the other one is some other more nuanced tool. But I want to talk about Bywater for a second. Why do you think Tyrion doesn't want to know Tommen's location?
I mean, I think it's just the idea that if the battle goes horribly awry, he can't be tortured for the information. So if he's captured in battle.
But he could be tortured for the information.
He could, but if he doesn't know, you know, he knows the starting point. but he doesn't know the next steps. So I think there is that sense of a guarding against uncertainty. And it's probably not just if he's caught and tortured. I think it's also just the rumor mill and the spies and the sort of high level endemic espionage of King's Landing. So I think it is this idea of, you know, two people can keep a secret if one of them is dead, sort of put into practice here.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, this actually won't stop anyone from torturing Tyrion for the information. It's just that they won't be successful in getting the information because he doesn't have it. But I was thinking, like, maybe he's trying to impress upon Bywater. It's like, no, this really is a secret. It's even a secret for me. That's how serious this secret is. I don't know if that's maybe an added benefit, because I honestly don't think that him not knowing is going to save him from torture. It might actually make it less likely that Tommen is found. And maybe that's the virtue of it.
I think so, because I think there's also, you know, we do have that one small conversation where Tyrion is asking about Tommen and how he is, and Bywater mentions that he doesn't miss his brother at all. And so I feel like there's often these moments, these asides, where Martin is trying to ensure that we don't forget that Tyrion, besides this being this expert, does have people and things he cares about. And Tommen and Myrcella being two of those. I think his sort of almost wistfulness when he remembers the Winterfell Godswood, and he seems to me at least like legitimately sad at the fall of Winterfell.
That was an odd moment. I wasn't sure what to make of that. Aside from like Martin just kind of reminding us that Winterfell was almost an idyllic place in the first book, and to make us lament a little bit that it's now been, you know, it's now fallen into Greyjoy hands. But what did you make of Tyrion's memory of Winterfell?
It's interesting because on the one hand, you know, he talks about standing there and never feeling more alien or apart or sort of a sense of not belonging somewhere. And yet the tone of the passage, or even thinking back to the descriptions of Tyrion in Winterfell from the first book, he actually seemed to fit in there and sort of find people to connect to in the North in a way that's surprising. And so that's not here. So I want to be careful about reading too much into it, but I do think there's a real sense of wistfulness of that is a place where people are honorable.
It's like he went to summer camp.
Winter camp. The food was terrible. The sleeping bag wasn't warm enough, but it was the best time I ever had.
Well, it is. It in terms of where Tyrion's been in his life, you know, that at this point, the trip to Winterfell and the trip up to the Wall probably was the most time he's ever spent outside of southern Westeros.
Yes.
And southern Westeros, for a Lannister, is an exhausting place, I would imagine. So maybe he was just sort of, he's sort of wistfully remembering how simple life was. But he's impressed by the religion, and he remember feeling like an outsider. And it wasn't just that he liked it, Winterfell. He remembered specifically, like that place had gravitas. I'm kind of shocked that it exchanged hands.
I think that's right. And, you know, this is also another chapter where we see a kind of a juxtaposition of this idea of something old and, as you say, with gravitas or even sacred is betrayed and passes on. Whereas in the conversation with the pyromancer, we have the return of old magic being noted as well. So this sort of passing into a new age that's very ambiguous, that sense, that liminal state, I think is also here in the mood. And you get the contrast, now I'm thinking about it a little more, between, again, the age and the depth of Winterfell with Tyrion's recollections of Theon, right? That callow youth. And so the idea that someone so unserious could do this is a sort of reflection of just the sort of chaos of this moment in time.
So anyway, that was an interesting little pause in this chapter, because there's a lot going on. There's a lot of preparation to be done in the city. But he does stop to, you know, read a couple letters. And one of the letters is like old news, and one of the letters is kind of fascinating to him. Like, oh my gosh.
Well, and I think it's also just important that, like, these are the ways that you keep the storylines in the North, the storylines in Essos, and the storylines in Westeros somehow connected. Like, yeah, we need some people who are aware of the larger scale of the conflict beyond sort of what's right in front of them. And I think Tyrion's one of the few people we would trust to sort of bifurcate his awareness like that, to keep his eye on the big picture plus all of the things that are right in front of his face.
Right.
In a way that I honestly don't know. Varys, maybe. There just aren't that many characters who I think could maintain that.
You need at least a couple characters who see more of the chessboard than others.
Mm-hmm. Right? Exactly. Exactly.
So Tyrion's definitely one of those guys.
Yes. And so I'm curious for you, when we get that kind of commentary, does Tyrion feel like a reliable narrator? Are we being tricked into trusting his reliability? Like, I'm just curious about, I mean, you've done this at such length and depth with each of the chapters. Do you get a feel for kind of his role as a narrative voice within the book?
Yeah. With certain things. I do think he's a curious mind, but he's also cynical. So he's also sort of like, he's not taking a lot at face value.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that sort of his effort to understand the deeper meaning of something, or the reality behind the veneer, is always right. It's just that he's doing that more than other characters. At least the characters we have a point of view on, right? So there are certain things that I would absolutely trust him with. Like, for instance, you know, he's thinking, oh, I get it. The Swan family is trying to hedge their bets.
Yes.
You know, so I trust that. You know, when he says, like, oh, they're having one of their sons become a member of the Kingsguard that will, ingratiate themselves to King's Landing. But the other boy, he's off with the other army. And so, you know, no matter who wins, the Swan family will be in a good position.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing I would trust Tyrion with. Certain things, like a woman's motivation. You know, there's certain things that Tyrion's quite foolish about.
No, why would you say that?
You know, he's always suspicious of Cersei. She's always scheming. Maybe he trusts his brother too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe he's too worried about what his father thinks of him. So in all of those ways, he is an unreliable narrator. But for the kind of the bigger picture, like we were talking, like, you know, as someone who has a greater view to more squares on the chessboard, maybe he's the best we have, you know, in this sort of chorus of unreliable voices. That's my sense of it anyway.
It's interesting because everything you were saying about, it's almost like the closer to his family we get, the less reliable he is, which is probably true of most of us. But sure. It circles back to Winterfell, right? Because that's when he's the furthest from his family's shadow. So he experiences kind of his own individuality at that point. And it's to some extent true in King's Landing, where my sense of the Cersei-Tyrion relationship as it's shown in this chapter is a sort of, I don't know, an uneasy détente, where there are things he's willing to concede to her. There are things he trusts her on and can even compliment her for her choice of Swan. But there's no Tywin. There's no Jaime. We don't get any sense of Joffrey in this chapter. So instead, it's almost like, again, he has his own spaces in which to work that he's established himself, again, as sort of an expert in.
Right. Well, we do get a little glimpse into Joffrey's psyche in this chapter. We find out that he gutted and skinned Tommen's pet cat at one point.
Oh, no, it's a cat, or was it a fawn?
Oh, that maybe that was it.
I can't remember. But either way.
Yeah, it's just this guy is just, he's got no redeeming qualities whatsoever.
No, we're never allowed to forget that, which is probably a good idea.
I do want to talk about siege preparation a little bit more. So I'm noticing the trebuchets. They've built three new trebuchets.
Yes.
They've called them the whores because they hope to give Stannis a lusty welcome.
Absolutely.
It's my impression, and I have done very, you know, I'm just kind of beginning my research into medieval warfare, so I'm quite a novice. But it's my impression that trebuchets and catapults look cool, but they're not very useful for a lot of things in warfare. That's my impression. What can you correct me on that? If I'm
no. Wrong? So they're stationed by the Mudgate, and the Mudgate is what faces out onto the river and then towards Blackwater Bay. Do I have my King's Landing geography right? I think
sounds
I do.
Sounds right to me, yeah.
And so against ships, well-placed catapults, ballistae, these sort of big stationary, what we could think of as like proto-artillery weapons, mm-hmm. can be effective. Because against big warships under sail, they aren't particularly maneuverable. If you set the range on these kinds of things, you can cause damage to a fleet. And so with that respect, they're relatively helpful. Okay. They're going to be less helpful kind of on the landward side. And instead, you would normally see catapults or trebuchets on with the besieging forces trying to weaken the walls, trying to keep defenders off the sort of battlements. So as defensive weapons, that would be my sort of overall impression. And, you know, you often see, so often I go back to the depiction of one force defending a castle versus outside armies. I think a lot of us were shaped by the Lord of the Rings in terms of visually how these things look. And there, you know, you do have in Minas Tirith, for instance, you know, they're hurling stones from the walls, and you might get some of that, but again, they aren't particularly effective in terms of against massed infantry kinds of soldiers.
Well, you see a giant boulder coming towards you, you move, you know, you run
as well as you can,
right? Yeah,
right. But it's much more, I mean, typically in sieges, it's more, you know, it's a lot of arrows. It's a lot of fire if they're sending siege tower ladders. Uh-huh. It's boiling oil. It's rocks. It's masonry that you're throwing down from the heights of the walls. So it's an interesting, you know, again, we see the strategy here in a way, which is Tyrion seems primarily focused on what's coming from the sea and secondarily focused, you know, with his clansmen as harriers in the woods and breaking supply lines. Like he's worried about what's coming from the land side, but he seems more interested in what's coming from the water.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. As he should.
As he should.
So the trebuchets probably are meant to, all right, let's take the wildfire out of this entirely, right?
Yes.
The trebuchets would be effective against a fleet. You can't move a ship nearly as fast as you can move a horse or, you know, on
correct.
Your own 2 feet.
And so, and also, again, just thinking about like once the chain is raised, uh-huh. and there, then you get ships kind of caught up at a known range with very little maneuverability. And so I mean, I see that as another sort of like big strategic advantage. But
Okay, that was my question about trebuchets. we get some interesting details about these ships that have been seized by just, you know, Bravosi traders and whatnot.
Yes.
I mean, I guess would that have been common practice? Like the city's about to be sieged. We're going to use every resource available. If you happen to be in the city, your stuff is at our disposal.
Yeah, you are completely SOL at that point in time.
Yeah.
particularly because it's like, do you want to survive? I mean, it's not as if the incoming army is going to distinguish between sort of non-combatant ships and whatever that Tyrion might have. So that strikes me as fairly common. And in the same way, like, you see this sort of balance that Tyrion is trying to strike between some vague sense of people and their property, but everything is geared towards the defense of the city. And so that is the destruction of the shanty town outside of the walls, where he says, give them time to gather their property and move, but it has to be destroyed. You know, we can't have any built structures that would provide cover, that would give people a means to gain height against the wall.
You could just climb up them, right?
That's right. That would hurt our field of fire. And so the idea of clearing out the wall makes perfect sense. Like that totally tracks with the kind of planning, and the ships would be in the same boat, or in the same way, you know, who has stores of food inside the city walls, who has iron, who has resources that can be used. All of that is going to be claimed for sure.
Was there anything else about this chapter that you thought was noteworthy or you wanted to talk about?
I think the preparation for the attack on King's Landing within the context of all the other Winterfell and Harrenhal and Storm's End, you know, we're in a piece of the book where castles are constantly falling, and almost entirely all of them are by deception, or there are circumstances where they are so deliberately undermanned that traditional defense doesn't work.
So that's interesting. So far in this book, we've got three fortifications that have changed hands, right? We have Storm's End, which was gained through witchcraft.
Demonic murder.
Yeah, right. We have Winterfell, that was gained through, you know, it was under defended, and the guy who was once fostered there kind of used his insider knowledge to kind of take it by stealth.
Yes.
Not to say that there wasn't some brute force, but it certainly wasn't a siege kind of situation, right?
No.
And then you've got Harrenhal, which is again treachery. It's that Vargo Hoat, you know, snuck these Northmen in. The Northmen got let out of the prison, although that was probably his plan all along. And then he swapped coats, right?
So. Yes.
In all of those ways, those castles are changing hands through treachery. And yet here we have this preparation for like straight ahead kind of approach to a siege. And eventually we'll find out that it's not successful.
Right.
But here we have the one situation where Tyrion is not going to make it easy for Stannis. And so much so that anyone that might commit the treachery has to be rounded up. And so for him, it's almost as if Varys is as much of a defense against this city as anything else he's got going for him.
Yes.
Because these castles tend to be taken by treachery more than anything else, right?
Treachery or starvation or like rampant disease is definitely normally how we would see these things play out if they do. I think it's funny here that this is where sort of I think the literary imperative versus the sort of imperative of realism are kind of at odds, because as much as I would love to see Martin, you know, write a really gnarly perspective chapters from the middle of a siege, like in month four. There's no room for that, right? Like that's a long, boring process of reports on the number of troops who have dysentery. So you have to push past it. And I think he's a good enough and careful enough historical thinker that in each case, he's like, so how can I take the reality, which is that this would be a very slow process, and speed it up.
What's the cheat code here, right?
Exactly. And what's fun is he uses different ones, right? Like sneaking in soldiers with fake wounds at Harrenhal versus, you know, as you say, like the sort of familiarity with Winterfell versus demon assassins versus here, you know, this technological ruse that eventually will play out. So it's an interesting way that he sort of gets around this reality. And I appreciate it because, again, no one wants to really read 150 pages
right
of an 8-month long Siege of King's
Landing. He'll do that a little bit later in Dance. What ends up happening is there's a long and boring wait outside of a castle, and Jamie will show up kind of, you know, late in the game. So you don't have to wait there with a POV character the whole time. But you do get a sense that, you know, this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, because I guess, I mean, River Run is one of the, it survives an attempt at treachery, freeing Jamie. And you have these sort of battles outside the gates, but it is, I guess, the case of, like, they have water. They have certain kind of, they have defenses that are pretty robust in place. And as a result, they do okay. And I guess that is the sort of counterexample for all of these other, it's the stories we didn't want to see told in some ways. But I think, and I will, this is like a minor piece of it, but what I do find fascinating in all of these is that it seems like there's this strange technological stasis with castles in Westeros, that they don't have a lot of the things we might associate, or many of them don't have the sort of, again, technology we would associate with defense. Like, why doesn't King's Landing have a moat? Or, and why does it have 7 gates? That's way too many gates. Gates are always the weak point in defending a city. And the answer is dragons.
The answer is always dragons. It's like, how would you build a castle, a medieval castle, if you had an arsenal that was airborne?
True. 100%
true. That could defend it, right? Because, you know, there's no, this, it makes no sense. This city makes no sense at all. I mean, I guess on, at least on partially the natural water defenses.
For half the city. Yeah.
Kind of serve as a moat, right? But it's not the same. But of course, you got dragons, so...
Sure, but there haven't been viable dragons for how many years at this point?
Right.
And so it's just one of those things where, like, I get why you wouldn't have a moat in Winterfell, because it would always be frozen. But you would come up with something else. And so oftentimes it just feels like... And it's not just the issue of fortification, but sometimes there are pieces of the world that feel frozen to me and sort of outside of any kind of...
Sure.
Historical sort of evolution in a way that historically we know actually would have happened. And it bothers me slightly.
I think that there's something about Martin's world that's a little bit of a synthesis. Like, if you just look at, like, the kinds of weaponry these different cultures have, he's pushed like 800 years of military development all into the space of like this one little book to make it more interesting, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is fine. But then, you know, you do encounter something like this where it's like, it does seem like it's a little bit stuck in the 10th century.
That's how it feels. And then, and this is my favorite when I teach students about it and we're sort of framing my Game of Thrones class. Like, one of the things I always say is, like, don't try to find perfect historical analogs to Game of Thrones, because that's not the project. And yes, you know, the War of the Roses and sort of 15th century British history has some similarities, but technologically, as you're saying, it's more 10th or 11th century. And then other aspects of it feel much earlier. And, you know, is the wall actually Hadrian's Wall? Well, that's classical. And so all along the way, I think Martin's greatest, in some ways, his greatest strength as an author in terms of world building is that this is such a compelling pastiche. And he's incredibly smart about how he combines elements from all of these different historical milieu. And I love it. Like, it's so much fun. But it's also, you know, don't get too caught up in what is and isn't there, which I just did. So I'm guilty of my own charges.
Well, it's one of those things where if you read closely enough and carefully enough, you will notice things that will make you scratch your head. You know, there's just no way that Martin, for all of the homework that he's done, there's no way that he's going to have the insight as the 300 medievalists who have written a book about this.
This is true. We have a little spare time. I haven't written about it, but I have one more question for you that is a slightly different topic, but I was reminded of in rereading this chapter, which is, when do people in Westeros start to be aware of Dany's dragons? Because we still have this moment here where the pyromancer kind of casually asks if there are any dragons around. And I was like, gosh, I could have sworn at least some people knew by now. Or how wouldn't they know by now? But do you remember exactly when that happens?
I would imagine that not many people know yet. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that is that, you know, there's kind of rumors of her going around. So they might know of her pregnancy, which came to naught, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because Jorah would have reported back.
Yes.
But after Drogo's pyre, and they get kind of lost in the wilderness and kind of get held up at Karth.
Right.
Who else is going to be able to communicate that information?
It would really have to be Varys, right? It would just have to be Varys's network.
It would have to be Varys's network, or one of these, you know, ship traders that Tyrion mm-hmm. encounters. That would be a way for him to find out. But clearly he hasn't, right? Or because, you know, this is really, you know, one of the notable introductions of this chapter is we find out for the first time that dragons re-entering the world absolutely does affect sort of global magic.
This is the first time we have someone say that explicitly, because it's certainly hinted at before.
Yeah, no, I think this is our first sort of explicit call out of that particular notion.
Okay.
Why are the pyromancers producing so mm-hmm. much more than they could before? The only explanation that they can come up with is, are there dragons nearby? Because that's kind of the generative force
mm-hmm.
for some of our spell work. And it does make me wonder, like, how many other people are enhanced by this global magic situation.
We have a strong sense that the priests and priestesses of the Red God, correct, are sort of intensified.
For sure them. But also, you know, sometimes I'm wondering, like, is sort of magic returning to the world's a larger theme? Because we've got, a little bit later, we got Corrin Halfhand saying, hey, look, the trees have eyes again. So mm-hmm. we should be open open our minds to a lot of things. It's almost like this is a little bit too tinfoily, I suppose. But, you know, there's a balance in this world. Mm-hmm. there's different kinds of magic, and when one kind of ramps up, we would expect the other side to ramp up as well. So we see, you know, more supernatural stuff happening in the north, more supernatural stuff happening in Essos, and here, in this case, we've got a more supernatural evidence in King's Landing, although I don't think that Tyrion really understands it as such yet.
No, his nature and skepticism would sort of predispose him against that. But I that doesn't strike me as tinfoily at all. Again, the idea that we're in a sort of transitional moment or an inflection point where you do have the sort of revival of magic in all of these different mm-hmm. forms, whether it's to oppose the Night King, whether it's he's a symptom of that as opposed to a cause of it. Mm-hmm. I don't think we get a full explanation of that. But even all of the, you know, the wolves and the Stark children, you know, like that's something that hasn't been seen, we're told, in centuries. So like this, I think, I don't know.
It is a major theme of this book if mm-hmm. you take the clues from the comet, right?
Yes.
So I don't know what the comet does. I don't know if the comet is the source or if the comet is a herald. I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of thought in the ancient world that the doings of the heavens will be, shadowed or mirrored here on Earth.
Yes.
So if there's a great happening in the heaven, we should expect that, you know, some great Caesar will be born or something like that.
No, I think, I mean, and again, I think we're probably left with a productive ambiguity around that, that we don't need to know exactly what the nature of it is. Only, as you say, there are all of these hints and these references back to the comet.
Yeah.
That it is happening, and it is happening in all of these different ways. And it is wildfire and its dragons and its wargs and its, you know, the red god. And even, I don't know, maybe, I don't know if we have a sense that the undying are stronger than they have been in the past, but it's certainly all coming together in a sort of foreboding way.
Notable introductions in this chapter. We hear about Lorien, the armorer, who's been treacherous. Tyrion's not going to end up getting his demon-shaped helm at this point because the blacksmith who he commissioned to make it is part of the Antler Men who are on Stannis' side. We have a little mention to the prince who drank wildfire. This is Arryon. I'm not sure if this is the first time this little lore has been hinted at, but we do meet Arryon in the Dunkin' Egg series. So I thought that was an interesting wink. Notable departures, the Timmit and the Stone Crows are the last of Tyrion's mountain clans to leave to kind of harry any forces that try to sneak through the Kingswood.
I do have to say, the scene in the beginning where Tyrion is trying to explain to the clansmen like how to do their job, and it's like this incredibly like almost maternal moment, and you know, then they come back like, I learned this when you were not alive, you know, we've been doing this forever, like
you're
you
trying
don't have
to
any
teach
ghosts.
Us guerrilla warfare
we it is
born conducting guerrilla warfare.
But it's kind of sweet. It's like a funny little bookend again to the Tommen stuff at the end, where you do see these bonds of affection that kind of ground Tyrion even amidst all of his sort of his planning and administrative work. So I just that part, I don't know, you imagine a little pat on the head for Tyrion.
Right. I think sweet. Timid actually does muss his hair or something.
Oh my god.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I got my coffee. It's a little bit lukewarm, but that's a midday problem generally for me. Hey, I want to let you know first that I got one of your books for Christmas, Medieval Military Technology, in second edition, which is always a good sign for a university press. And
yes, definitely the better of the two.
Fantastic. Like, I will interview authors from time to time, and usually what happens is I'll read like two or three chapters just to get a sense of the book. Not only did I read it cover to cover, I've read a few sections multiple times. This is just a ton of new information to me. Congratulations. And
no, thank you very much.
Thank you for writing such an excellent book.
It was the first edition was my first book, and it did fairly well, but it was a small press, and the University of Toronto Press took over, and they asked for a second one, and I was really pleased to do it. And And since then, I've done a reader that for original sources that has gone
perfect.
over very
What's
well.
All right, let's plug that one. What's the title of that one?
It's just Medieval Warfare, a reader, University
All
of
right.
Toronto Press.
Right. And people do search Kelly DeVries
Yeah, the
and
breeze.
they'll find that. Wonderful. Well, I'm excited about this. I'd love to run this quote past you. This is what George Martin writes in A Clash of Kings. The character who's quoting this is a guy named Jocelyn Bywater. He's talking about the City Watch. There are hundreds greener than spring grass, men who join for bread and ale and safety. No man likes to look craven in the sight of his fellows, so they'll fight brave at the start when it's all war horns and blowing banners. But if the battle looks to be going sour, they will break, and they will break bad. The first man to throw down his spear and run will have 1,000 more trotting on his heels. What do you think about that?
And that's absolutely accurate. And I mean, medieval warfare is not fought to the death. It's fought until somebody runs away.
Oh, interesting.
So if we take, for example, the Battle of Towton, which is the largest battle on English soil throughout the Middle Ages, we've got Yorkists coming in and they're facing the Lancastrians, and the Yorkists under Edward IV will defeat the Lancastrians. They do it pretty easily. They do it generally because their arrows can hit the other side. They've got the wind in their direction. They can hit the other side, and the other side can't hit them. So the other side archers say, "Yeah, we're gone." And once they started to run back away from the battlefield, then they others do follow them, and the battle's soon over.
Okay, all
Most
right.
medieval battles are very short because this will happen, and most of these bodies that have been found that have aided us in our understanding of wounds and so forth that were found in town, all of those were people fleeing who were ridden down. That's why they've all got holes in the back of their head or something, because they're being ridden down and somebody's stabbing them with a knife or a dagger or a sword or a hammer of some sort or an axe. And that's because they're running away. That's how many battles were ended, is the first army to flee lost. And I know George does his homework. I was on a couple of shows that he also was on. He worked with the Wars of the Roses, the Battle of Towton. So he may have even been inspired by the Battle of Towton. Because this is what it was. I mean, we did have some veterans. We do know there were veterans among the force, but it's hard to stay put if your army is dissolving. And so we frequently see this at the Battle of Poitiers. The first two French lines will hit the English, and they're pretty well done in, but there's still a huge army to go. As the English move towards the main French force, the third line leaves. And that both aided the Black Prince who's commanding the English at Poitiers to now be able to advance on on the main body, which is where the king is, and capture the king and also put an end to the conflict. He should have lost easily because he was outnumbered so much as he was.
So for me, it's interesting that it's like there's this shift where it looks like the momentum has turned. This is a lost cause,
Yes.
or is it? I thought I would fight to the death, but in the face of it, I've changed my mind. Which, or is it both?
Yeah, I think, well, nobody wants to die on the battlefield, and nobody sees a cause in the Middle Ages that there isn't this kind of cause that you're going to fight for. When the, for
They're
example, the
not
Flemings, no,
Klingons. They don't,
they're
they're
not
not.
Klingon.
All right.
There are other incentives. I mean, when the English, I'm sorry, when the Flemings face the French at Courtrai, and the Flemings only have militias, the urban militias, the what incentivizes them to stay put? Well, there's two things. One is that the commanders wisely put the troops with their backs towards the river that would have been too difficult for them to cross. And then the second thing is he says, look, we are it. The French are coming in. They're going to go hit your families. They're going to destroy your families and, you know, rape your wives and do everything else. I mean, it's the depredations that are always highlighted in some of these, and not necessarily the courage and honor, because that won't mean anything to a baker or a meat cutter or something like this. That's how it, you know, the Flemings then recognize their last defense in protection of their families, protection of their livelihoods, and in protection of their cities. And so those will incentivize someone to stay around, but it even that'll break down if he sees that the entire army is fleeing. There's a very interesting quote that comes out of the Battle of Crecy when the urban militias get there. So Philip the Sixth of France has stupidly sent in his starts the battle at dusk and sends in his main force. Most of his army hasn't arrived at the battlefield when he starts the battle. The urban militias are coming towards the end, and there's somebody who says, I can't remember exactly who wrote this, but said the militias all showed up at the battle. They all saw it was finished, it was going badly for Philip, and they left, save the Orleanais, those from Orleans, who went onto the battlefield and died to a man. So what got the Orleanais to go in when the others obviously saw that Philip had lost the battle by this time, and that it would be futile to do that, and it would be better for them just to keep going and head back towards France? We don't know, but that seems to give us an indication that the certain troops coming in, or their officers or leaders, in the case of the militias, they would have been town leaders. They could very easily see that the French are not winning at Crecy. Why stick around?
Well, also that is an exceptional thing. You know, usually you wouldn't see an entire
army
die to a man.
Well, and in fact, I would doubt that the Orleanais, I think that that's more just the hyperbole of the person who's writing. Yeah. Oh, they died to a man, meaning that they were, you know, went into battle at the wrong time and were absolutely destroyed. That there were probably those who came who were able to get away, especially since darkness was falling. I think the point he's making is that they went in when the other urban militias did not. So the militias that would have been there from Paris, militias that had been there from various towns in the South France, Orléans is pretty far from Crecy, that they would have seen that situation and left. Now, it's very unusual for a leader to not wait till his entire army was there before he started the battle. There are exceptions. Battle of Bouvines in 1214 is a similar one to this one, where units will arrive on the field. And so the battle is actually almost like a wave going from the front to the back. But in this case, they just said, no, we're not going on the battlefield. Most often the entire army will be on there. They will put them up front. They will put them into two lines, and then you'll have the unit or the line dissolve as they run it away, and that'll carry the rest of them forward.
That brings me to my next question. This is from Dottie. She says, I get the sense from modern depictions of medieval warfare that honorable battles were conducted by adult men and adult men alone. On the other hand, when women and children are asked to fight, it is a sign of desperation or something less than honorable. First, does this mentality sound like an accurate representation of history? Second, are there examples when women and children are asked to fight? And if so, how were they used in battle? So it sounds like, you just mentioned an example of how you might use them as human fodder from a particular Eastern point of view.
Well, from an Eastern point of view, no one used children, first of all. No one used children. If and
not even to run and get arrows if you needed to.
No,
get,
nobody to get arrows. Yeah. I mean, and there's still a few people who say, oh, well, when they were running out of arrows, they'd send guys out to get it. No, that's just stupid. They wouldn't come back. I mean, there's no way. And you can't
have,
use an arrow
have
that's
the,
in the ground.
The tennis ball boys running across the back.
Yeah, you don't. You wouldn't use an arrow that has already been in the ground because that's the weight is all off at this point.
Okay,
and it doesn't, you know, it's just a stupid notion.
Okay.
And there's no evidence ever behind it. It's just, you know, what do we do when we run out of arrows? Well, they leave or they get more. That's it.
Yeah.
Children are never in. We do know that young men would fight at the age of 16, 15 and 16. The Black Prince is 16 at Battle of Crazy, for example.
And women,
there is one example of a woman in a battle in the entire Middle Ages, and that's Joan of Arc. And she is very special, very different. I've written a book on her, and you know, there's no question Joan is a very, very different person. But we don't have anybody else serving in battle. Now, where do women come into play in warfare? At sieges. So if you were being besieged by an army, let's say Calais in 46-47, and the women in the town are in charge of bringing to the men on the walls, if there's an active charge and so forth, an active attack at the walls. And they would bring supplies and they would bring food and other things, but they would not participate in the warfare. Now, every once in a while, a town or a fortress would have the men on campaign somewhere. And at that point, then they had to try to keep the enemy troops out. Mm. And so there was some fighting that could be done, never hand to hand. Because the walls would do the trick generally in keeping the troops out of the town. So there were very few women that would fight at any time during the Middle Ages. No children, very few women. The exception being the exception, which is Joan of Arc. And that there's never going to be, there was never another Joan of Arc, and there never would, it will be another Joan of Arc.
This brings me to another quote from the book. We're talking about siege warfare. This is Tyrion's observation as he's preparing to defend King's Landing. This is what he's thinking. He says, "Mounted, he gazed along the riverfront. Hammers rang in the air as the carpenters swarmed over the mudgate, extending wooden hoardings from the battlements. He was a less deal pleased with the clutter of ramshackle structures had been allowed to grow up behind the quays, attaching themselves to the city walls, like barnacles on the hull of a ship. Bait shacks and pot shops and warehouses and merchant stalls and ale houses and cribs were the cheaper sort where whores spread their legs. It had to go, every bit of it. As it was, Stannis would hardly need scaling ladders to storm the walls." So it seems like There's shops that people have built against the city wall on the outside.
Yeah.
And he's worried that if that city is under siege, then those will become kind of a makeshift ladder. So what he ends up having done is he has them burned. He has these things burned on the exterior of the wall.
Yeah. And probably on the interior. Anything that's attached to the wall is going to be brought down, because you don't want them to get to the point of being on the wall and then being able to easily get into town. That doesn't do any good either. So these structures that were on both sides. It's curious, the ones that are on the outside are always called suburbs. You know, you've got herbs of the town, and then you've got suburbs.
Sure. So anyway, the suburbs, the suburbs are right on the other side of the wall.
Of the wall, yeah. And I mean, it's logical. You've got a walled town. If you go to many medieval towns, like, say, Aachen, which is where Charlemagne had his capital, There's remnants of the walls that he built. Then there's remnants of at least two other roundings of walls, the last one being 15th century, because the town keeps growing. Mm. And so you need to take the suburbs in. You can't have them hanging out on the outside because those people have to be protected as well.
And would you normally burn those, or would you just deconstruct them?
They were
or?
Mostly wooden. Yeah, they were mostly wooden. They would be burned because you didn't, you wouldn't allow anything with stone be built on those, because that would just simply enable ruins to be used as precisely that, easy access to the walls.
And why burn? Why take down the ones on the inside of the wall then?
Well, you wanted an area on the inside that that, as the troops say, they come over the walls. You want to be able to set up some form of defense. And if they're coming down on houses and other things on the inside of the walls, then it just, it means that you cannot put in that defense. You cannot fight on the roofs of houses. So if it's a town that's going to be like a city like Constantinople or Rhodes, it's going to be besieged by large forces, the force is going to be attacking, and at that point they're both attacking with very large gunpowder weapons on the side of the besiegers. You're going to have to have an area within the walls that is a bit that is free to fight those guys that are coming through breaches or that are coming over up and over the walls, and you can't have houses there either.
So now, is the idea here to make it difficult for, once you've gotten up the wall, getting down the wall is going to be equally difficult?
Yeah, yeah. You've got to use the stairs, the same ones that the citizens are using who are manning the walls.
Okay. And once you're on the other side of the wall, would you, like, would the commoners, are they now, you know, they're going to have to pick up a bow or pick up a sword, or what happens?
The men will be all trained as militia, unless they're very old or very young. They will all be trained as militia, and they will aid in the attack, yeah, or aid in the defense of the city, yeah.
And do the women ever pick up a bow or anything like that?
So, sometimes bow. There are militia. So we've got some pretty good records of militias in large towns like Florence in 1280s, 1260s, 1280s. And there's three types. There's the cavalry militia, the infantry militia, and the crossbow militia. Hmm. And they're all told what they have to bring to the battle or to a siege. You know, but nobody who's trained as a spearman or trained with a sword is going to be using a crossbow. Because by the time the people are inside the town, crossbow is not going to be very effective. It's going to be hand-to-hand combat. And you can't be shooting somebody with a crossbow when they're involved in fighting another person.
Right.
So,
right.
So it's limited. So you wouldn't want to train. There were clubs, especially in the large towns by the end of the Middle Ages, Bruges and Ghent, Ypres up in the Flanders, for examples, or Florence and Milan and Venice and other places in northern Italy. And they had groups that shot crossbows almost as competition, fun, and they would be good enough that that's what they could use in the city should it be attacked or entered. And they would be used on the walls before hand-to-hand combat in the city. So they would have been shooting crossbows quite a bit.